Okay, so on our panel tonight we have Peter Kahn, who is the writer and director. His previous work with Talking Birds includes A Trade in Lunacy and A Malady of Migration, which are the other two pieces as part of the Asylum Trilogy, which tonight is the final piece. We also have Professor Hilary Marland and Associate Professor Catherine Cox, and they are the co-principal investigators on the Prisoners' Medical Care and Entitlement to Health project. It's a welcome-funded project that examines the history of medical care in prison since 1850, and it is their work on the history of mental illness that forms the underpinning research to tonight's show. So to kick off the panel discussion, I'd like to ask Peter if he can reflect a little bit about what it's been like working with historians and historic material during the creative process, but also Hilary and Catherine, why you chose to use theatre to communicate this original historic research, and what are the benefits to that, to disseminating it to a wider audience?
Okay, well, working with these clever people is great because they do all the research and I don't have to do it. So this is the third one that we've done together, the third collaboration, and they have been really interesting, and they all had different challenges. Obviously the challenge in this one was doing a play about solitary confinement in silence, and something which is quite bleak and had very tragic consequences for a lot of the convicts, the invade, without making it unrelentingly miserable. And what's great about working with this team is that you can always go back to them and say, look, I don't understand this, or you have a question, and rather than spending ages Googling it, you go to these human Google machines and they come up with really sophisticated answers. So it's a great way of collaborating, I think.
And Pete asks really hard questions, I have to say, that... Because, I mean, for us, I think it's a completely new way of interpreting the material we have. And Pete used the material, in some cases, very closely. I mean, we gave him things like memoirs, case notes, chaplains and medical officers' journals. But then he takes them and makes this wonderful script. And I think it helps us to think about the kind of experiences that prisoners might have. So to really sort of start to address our historical research in a quite different way than we're used to. So it not only gives us an opportunity to present to different audiences, I think, but it gives us a new way of thinking about our work. But I think, you know, the connection with theatre and history as well gives you a kind of opportunity to open up conversations on quite difficult subjects as well, around mental health and stigma, and in this case, the relationship of imprisonment to mental health.
Yeah, and I think also it gives us an opportunity to reach people whose voices we can't hear. I literally didn't mean that as a pun. So with this project in particular, it's very hard to get to the prisoner's voice. You know, the records, a lot of them are official records. They're the records of the... You're lucky if you get a record of a chaplain or a school teacher. Mm. It's really, really hard to get the voice of the prisoner themselves. And I think the collaboration with Peter and with Talking Birds really allows a way of accessing that. And in a way, I think that historians are probably... You know, we get slightly obsessed about footnotes and is this a good source? And, you know, with accuracy, this notion, but it frees us from that, I think. Mm. While Peter, at the same time, always makes sure that his work is grounded and, you know, carefully researched. So I think that collaboration works really well.
Okay, great. Now we're going to open up the floor to questions. If you could give me a wave, and although this mic won't amplify your voice, it is recording for the live streaming, so if you could speak into the mic.
This might be a bit kind of open-ended, but from what you've learned from the history of imprisonment and mental illness, has that changed your opinion on how your thoughts on imprisonment now and the prison system now?
Well, it's distressing for us to think that many people in prison still experience separation or solitary confinement, although the conditions are completely different and the kind of rationale behind it is completely different from the mid-19th century when it was produced, you know, it was introduced as a reformative measure. So that for us is a very sobering idea, that while it's rather less in the English and Irish context, which are the two contexts we're researching. And still, I think the Howard League estimated that one third of people in prison will experience a spell in solitary confinement. And we also know that in the United States, for example, that 80,000 prisoners, roughly, are in solitary, which, or segregation as it's often called, which is pretty much equivalent to the whole prison population in England and Wales. So, I mean, that for us is a kind of worrying piece of information. So it certainly makes us think very much about that aspect of the prison system.
Yeah. I mean, I was about 2 weeks ago on a different project working with ex-offenders. I mean, it's one thing being a historian and reading these accounts of people experiencing distress and delusions in cells. And then I was talking to this ex-offender and he was sort of talking about where he lived for 3 years, which was a cell, and how to get out of it. He thought about suicidal acts. So it sort of made it very real for me, sort of going from what you think is 150 years ago to 3 years ago.
For me, although I'm from Liverpool, I've never actually been in prison. So, I learnt a lot. It's historical, and I hadn't realised that Pentonville was a conscious social experiment. And experimenting with people's lives and you know, how long can they spend in isolation? And it really made you think about the effects of isolation and being shut up inside your own head and what that does to you, being forced to think of your of what you've done and also the hopelessness of your future. It did open up a lot of thoughts about how we deal with what's our responsibility for reformation? Not in the way that it was in the 19th century and in this play, but we do have a responsibility not for punishment, but for rehabilitation, regeneration, whatever it is, to create a more wholesome society.
Mm. And the actual recollections of our 19th century prisoners often have very striking parallels with the way prisoners report that experience of being in isolation today. It's actually very, very noticeable. The language, although it's separated by that huge time period, 150 years, is quite alarmingly similar. And it was a very nice touch that the clerk, for example, when deprived of books, starts to lose his memory and become very confused. And that's, again, a sort of symptom that's often reported today, that this sort of loss of memory, loss of ability to socialise. So not just, you know, the more flamboyant kinds of mental illness, which were also depicted in the play, but these sort of long-term psychological effects as well.
And worry over family. Worry over family, that seems to be another theme that you can track throughout the from the 19th century today. Just worry about how family are getting on and anxiety about how losing touch with family members.
Thank you. So as somebody who works a lot about the Holocaust and concentration camps, if you are interested in the so-called total institutions, you go back to Foucault. And Foucault infamously claimed that basically the human society and people and agency are ground to nothing. And then lots of historians disagree with them. And of course, you work about something very specific about the solitary. And I do wonder, what do you find out about that? Does it destroy people? Does it destroy the agency? Do you find some people who go through it and kind of emerge, if you can say, quote unquote, normal? Or was Foucault right? And does it produce something like kind of robots?
One of an important character in the play is the guy that does survive. Mm. Although he's illiterate, he finds a way of coping with it through invention and imagination and those defense mechanisms. That's quite, because so there were people, there are people who do it, but that's not. That's it, despite of the system, not because of the system. So, and that's why that character was in it.
when, and Pete, you drew quite a lot on some prison memoirs as well, didn't you? And they talk of agency in some cases. I mean, they're often not, they're speaking about their own experiences, but these tend to be written by kind of well-educated, literate prisoners, of course, because they, you know, many of the prisoners couldn't write and talk about their own experiences. But they also took responsibility for speaking for other prisoners. And they do talk about these sort of survival techniques and the resistance that's developed. And it could be something quite, well, books were an important source, or anything you could read. But also the kind of routines that prisoners developed as a kind of defence mechanism to fill the days. Mental tests, doing mental arithmetic, all sorts of things are referred to in these memoirs as a way of sort of surviving this system. So... yes, on the one hand, you have this really oppressive power structure. But you also have doubts start to emerge amongst those officials who are running it. I mean, after a few years, even the chaplains are starting to say, this is really not working that well, and we're experiencing far too much mental breakdown. So there is this questioning of the system by the people who are enforcing it as well, which occurs pretty quickly after the introduction of separate confinement.
So by the time separate confinement is introduced to Mountjoy Prison in Dublin, so that's 1850, they're already saying, well, you can't use the full period of 12 months, you need to reduce it to 8 months, you need to make other slight adjustments in terms of the power of the chaplain and the power of the school teacher. So, and yet they're still saying, we know this creates mental disorder, but we're still committed to it. So they're aware of it, but they're adjusting the system to accommodate that.
Thank you. I, whilst being left rather depressed at how over the sweep of history of 150 years we seem to have learnt so very little. My question was, when you're working together and you come from very different disciplines, sorry, I mean little about the prison system, not about your work, from very different disciplines, Hilary, you mentioned at the beginning that Peter asked the most difficult questions, and I wondered what was the most difficult question and why was it so difficult?
Okay, well, there are often bits of information that we don't know. Like one question you asked was whether prison staff would go into a cell on their own. And actually, it's really hard in the documentation to find. So it was actually more probably difficult. I didn't mean in a kind of emotional way. It was more tricky, challenging questions, which
I think that's what makes it interesting.
Which actually, you know, so we did look and try to find out. Mm-hmm. And our impression was, yes, indeed, the schoolmaster and the chaplain would in many instances be alone in the cell with a prisoner. So it was... you got us to go back and look at our material quite often and to find out things which are actually really important to know.
Like what exactly did they read other than the Bible? You know, you sort of, what exactly was the reading material that was provided when it was available? So, yeah.
So, tricky questions.
Precise questions.
Precise questions.
Hi there. I think this is more, I guess, a question around the production and the casting of female actresses or actors. Was there a particular motivation in terms of swapping the gender of the actors in relation to who they were portraying, or just the way casting went?
There were several reasons for it, some pragmatic and some artistic. We wanted characters who could play a range of characters. When we started, we had to start casting it before we had to know who we were going to have before I started writing it, because you have to pick, you have to get a cast that far in advance. And then we just decided it would be really interesting to have that slightly distancing effect of having men played by women, so that and then the implication is that the academics, the people that are investigating it, are women. So you're having a women's perspective on what was an experiment in this play on largely the male population. So those were the main reasons for it. We also knew that we had one We'd fixed one actor that we'd already agreed to do in it, and we just decided it would be really interesting. It would be an experiment, rather like the Pentonville experiment. So it was a mixture of things, really. I'm going to ask you a question now. How did it make you feel as a member of the audience? Was it easy to accept that convention? They would, yeah.
And that was, I think, the bit that struck me. That prompted me to think about it. I think if I had been male actors, I probably wouldn't have thought that. Mm-hmm.
No. Mm-hmm. And although it was a play largely about, because of the historical time that we were looking at, some of the observations, some of the basis of the characters' actions were based on accounts of female prisoners, which were then transferred to the characters in the play.
And of course, I mean, the experiment was tried out on female prisoners as well. I mean, there were female prisons prisons dedicated for women built at this period. Rachel is working on women in prison, but you know, the size of and the length of time the women prisoners were kept in solitary confinement was shorter again, because the idea was that they weren't able to withstand the taxing sort of regime, that therefore they couldn't benefit from it in the same way. You're doing work as well on English prisons, but I've mainly looked at the Mountjoy female prison. And I suppose you come up, there are a smaller number of prisoners, because of course the female prison population is smaller. But what's interesting is there's quite a large number that do go insane. And there are concerns by the 1880s that are actually more female prisoners are being moved into Dundrum Lunatic Asylum than male prisoners. So whether that's, you know, about accessing facilities or, you know, moving women out sooner, because women are seen as troublesome as well, generally, even before they develop mental illness. So, and I don't know if you've had a chance to look at that for England.
It's quite interesting, because they do, in some ways they acknowledge that it is a mental illness problem, but then in other ways there's a lot of broader issues that come into play with women, so things about mania, things about recurrent mania, and different things that aren't necessarily discussed for men, but they are seen as very much a women problem. And sometimes it's seen as, is it a discipline problem, is it a health problem, and they find it really difficult. So for example, when they opened Brixton Prison in 1853 for women, in the first few years they find... I get the impression it's quite difficult, and they're trying to reconcile health with punishment and discipline. And some women clearly do have agency in the sense that they act up and they know that they can't punish them in certain ways like they would men. But other women, it's quite clear that they are mentally ill. But whether that's recognised is quite dicey sometimes.
And of course, the female prisoners, for instance, in Liverpool, which is an unusual prison, there are very large numbers of female prisoners in there, but they're in for very short terms. You know what I mean? There's a huge number of prostitutes, Irish prostitutes, that are in and out of the system. I think you came across a woman that was in for her 100th commitment.
Yeah, so, or drunken disorderly.
Drunken disorderly as well, and it's short term. So they're a different sort of group.
And you do find a touch of humour when referring to women prisoners, and Liverpool had a particular problem of overcrowding because the throughput of the prison was so huge, so they had to double up in cells. And the remark, this was particularly bad for the women prisoners, because if you couldn't keep them in separation, then they would gossip and chat. Mm-hmm. So depriving them of that was seen as part of the real punishment of separation, that you would prohibit them from this daily contact and chit-chat. So there were particular reference to this.
I enjoyed the play. It left me with a number of thoughts and questions. The first question was about scale of this phenomena of mental health issues inside prisons. The second question is about what happened when prisoners were released. Do we know if they recovered? Do we know if they actually stayed in that state of mental disorder? The third question relates to the other parallel system, I guess, of putting insane patients into institutions, and whether there was any crossover between the research that you're doing and the other world of treating people who were unhappy and had mental health issues, but in a different way. And the fourth question was, can you tell us a little bit about when it all came to an end and how it was resolved, if ever?
Yeah? Well, should we have a go and then we'll
remind us what we
help
missed.
Each other out? It's very hard to actually calculate the number of people with mental health problems in prison during the 19th century, partly because the prison system is undergoing a process of denial, if you like, or damage limitation. So part of the response to these cases of mental illness was to say, well, it's not the system. People are coming into prison already mentally ill or with mental weakness, as they often refer to it. But there's a sort of caginess, really. You do have official reports which list the number of mentally ill prisoners each year, but they're always underestimates. And one of the ways they do that is they use a very distinct set of terminologies to describe people in prison with mental illness. So they use terms that we never find in asylums, for example, in the same period, like irritability. They talk a lot about delusions, but they don't necessarily see that as real mental illness. Some prisoners, however, were moved into the asylum system. So in London, prisoners from Pentonville, for example, would go to Bethlehem, but in fairly small numbers. So it was the kind of last resort. And those prisoners would be labelled insane. So a quite distinct term would be used for them. And we have been able to do a bit of tracking of prisoners between institutions, particularly in the Liverpool context. We've done a lot of work on Liverpool in our previous project. And there's an immense amount of movement back and forth, partly while they're deciding whether the prisoner is really mentally ill. And the other thing the prisoner is really interested in is feigning mental illness. So they claim that many prisoners are acting up, pretending to be mentally ill, so they can be moved to an asylum where the conditions are a lot better and the system of care is completely different. So we know a little bit about some prisoners when they move into the asylum system. When they're transported, we haven't been smart enough yet really to figure out
what happens.
I think this work we could do with a lot of colleagues who are working on the convict system and who have very good records of what happened when they arrive in Van Diemen's Land and other places. So I think there's more collaboration we could do in the future to track some of those prisoner patients. But some do end up in asylums and presumably for the rest of their lives in
some
cases.
And some escape from the asylums afterwards. I mean, that's a concern as well, that they're actually, you know, when they're concerned about the issue of feigning, they're also concerned that actually when they get moved into the asylum, that then they're using that as a means to escape from the whole system. And that actually does happen. Another thing about when you think about whether they recover, one of the sort of management techniques is that when somebody starts displaying signs of mental disorder while in the cell, they move them to association, to work in association, or into the hospital. And then they seem to recover. And this, of course, is seen as evidence of feigning. But sometimes it's seen as evidence of being inherently weak and not able for the system. So you do have these sort of recoveries. You know, they're sometimes quite partial, shall we say.
In terms of the Pentonville experiment, in which the majority of the prisoners, it was secondary punishment. They were on their way to transportation to Australia. And so I looked up, did some research on what happened to some of those. And a lot of them did then sort of start again, have a new life, and had a positive life, and others became cricketers. So there was a whole mixture of things. But there were, some actually changed their social status, rose into higher up in a social hierarchy than they would have done in this country, probably.
I mean, there's research that suggests now that people who, when they were transported to Australia, that their life expectancy was greater than those that stayed in England or Ireland. So,
And some of them wrote home. Some of them did write back to the chaplains and said, you know, you saved me, you turned me around. And the chaplains, of course, love these stories and publish them in great big volumes.
Yeah.
So you have those sort of accounts, not necessarily people who've been mentally ill, but these great redemption stories which were recounted back.
Yeah, I think we've got time for one more question.
Well, we would argue never.
Well, the separate system fizzles out in the early 20th century, doesn't it, really?
Yeah. But solitary confinement continues to be used throughout this period, so...
Yeah.
So.
But there's what is kind of amazing is the persistent reliance on it, despite all these indications that in many ways it wasn't effective. The prisoners were also still reoffending once they stopped transportation. Of course, they stay in the criminal justice system in England and Ireland. And reoffending is seen as a huge problem. So it doesn't solve any of the problems it set out to, but there's still this incredible faith in it. And it becomes more and more about punishment as the 19th century progresses. So they lose that sort of reformative interest and idea they will kind of redeem and improve these prisoners. It becomes much more about imposing appropriate punishment through separation. So it becomes even grimmer, if you like, in some ways, because there was at least this kind of faith, inspiration in the early years.
It's a kind of two-part shared question.
Wanted to ask you just about how you arrived at the project in terms of what drew you to it, and also current, because we're all studying applied theatre and are very drawn into the kind of creative rehabilitation side of things, and just reformity. Just about that, and also why can you explain the wearing white? Your reason behind the
so the I was drawn initially not to this project, because this is the third of the Asylum trilogy, starting with The Trade in Lunacy, which was 3-4 years ago.
Malady
was 2014, so.
Right, okay.
Yeah, 13, yeah.
And what drew me to that was it just seemed fascinating, and it was an opportunity to collaborate with serious researchers who would know an awful lot more than I could find out in a short time, or a team of us. So it was that opportunity, and then to collaborate in lots of. I like working with Des as a composer, and working with these particular actors was something which was very attractive. Why they wear white? It's not quite white. It's a sort of whitish. It's a through line through the whole of the three pieces. Partly because it's neutral. It's something which, because it doesn't have a character in itself, the performers can use that neutrality to build characters on. And all of the plays have this colour system, this muted, bleached out colour system, which then again works very well to have the splashes of colour on and the work of the actors. Does that answer your questions?
Was it to do with the clinical? Was there a
And yeah, no, well, yeah. This is probably whiter than the others, which was Janet, the designer's idea. Yeah, and because it is more clinical and more hard, and the lighting, which is Kath, reflects that clinical examination. So it's set out that one of the reasons why we had the audience in the round is as though you are examining this system, like the characters in the play were, and it's sort of like under the microscope or as a laboratory, and it has that clinical whiteness of costume, and that's how Kath looked at the lighting. So it's harsh, and it's an examination. Good.
Great. Well, I'm sure if anybody has any more questions, you could catch our panel. But I'd like to end by congratulating Catherine, Hillary, Peter, and everybody at Talking Birds on producing and performing a very thought-provoking piece.